Vampire, der Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben.
Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Vampire, dem Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben. Mein Name ist Rasha Hayat, ich bin Schriftstellerin, Übersetzerin und Literaturaktivistin. Für diese neue Folge von Vampire weichen wir ein wenig von unserem gewohnten Konzept ab. Normalerweise lade ich mir ja immer Autorinnen ein, um mit ihnen über ihre Schriftstellerinnen-Vorbilder zu sprechen und uns über deren Werke auszutauschen. Aus besonderem Anlass begrüße ich dieses Mal aber die israelisch-amerikanische Schriftstellerin, Aktivistin und Kuratorin Shelly Oria mit ihrem aktuellen Projekt I Know What's Best for You – Stories on Reproductive Freedom. In den USA wurde kürzlich das Recht auf legale Schwangerschaftsabbrüche vom obersten Gerichtshof gekippt und stürzte das Land in eine noch tiefere Krise in Sachen Gesundheitswesen, Frauenrechte, Menschenrechte und Demokratie insgesamt. Auch weltweit sind konservative Kräfte längst auf dem Vormarsch, um die Rechte von Menschen, die nicht männlich und weiß sind, dramatisch einzuschränken. Aus diesem Anlass hat Shelly sich mit dem amerikanischen Verlag McSweeney's zusammengetan und eine absolut fantastische Anthologie kuratiert, die über 50 Kurzgeschichten, Essays, Gedichte, Theaterstücke, Fotografien sowie auch einen Comic enthält, verfasst von einer ebenso diversen Gruppe von Autorinnen und Autoren sämtlicher Geschlechter, Orientierungen und Zugehörigkeiten. Es ist ein unglaublich starkes, beeindruckendes Buch geworden, das viele Aspekte weiblicher, körperlicher Autonomie und Fortpflanzungsfragen aus den unterschiedlichsten Perspektiven beleuchtet. Zusätzlich zu dem amerikanischen Kontext gibt es auch ein internationales Supplement, I Know What's Best for You All Over the World, mit Texten unter anderem aus China, Afghanistan, Argentinien. Und es ist auch mir eine unfassbar große Ehre, auch einen Text zu diesem, wie ich finde, wahnsinnig wichtigen Buch und lebenswichtigen Thema beigetragen zu haben. Aus der Perspektive der Bikulturalität natürlich, was auch sonst. Zusätzlich zur inhaltlichen Wichtigkeit geht außerdem ein Teil des Erlöses der Buchverkäufe an Organisationen, die in den USA Frauen dabei unterstützen, wenn sie nun für einen Schwangerschaftsabbruch in einen anderen Bundesstaat reisen müssen. Vor diesem aktuellen Projekt hat Shelly Oria bereits eine andere erfolgreiche Anthologie kuratiert, Indelible in the Hippocampus, Writing from the MeToo Movement, über genau das, die MeToo-Bewegung, ebenfalls bei McSweeney's erschienen. Unser langes Gespräch zieht viele Kreise und Wege über Aktivismus und Kunst, über die Unterschiede zwischen Deutschland und den USA, die Kraft von Fiktion, darüber, warum auch männliche Autoren und Kritiker manchmal ein Problem darstellen, wenn es darum geht, weibliche Themen sichtbar zu machen und woher wir die Kraft nehmen, weiterzumachen. Es sind alles Themen, die mir persönlich sehr wichtig sind und sehr am Herzen liegen und von denen ich glaube, dass sie uns allen am Herzen liegen sollten, wenn wir nicht wollen, dass unsere Welt völlig in der Dunkelheit versinkt. Die Bücher sind übrigens auch bei uns in Deutschland bestell- und lieferbar, bei jedem Buchladen eurer Wahl. Alle weiteren Links findet ihr wie immer in der Beschreibung zu diesem Podcast. Das Gespräch führen wir auf Englisch und nun wünsche ich euch ganz viel Spaß bei diesem sehr, sehr intensiven Gespräch mit Shelly Oria.
Shelly, welcome to Vampire, and thank you so much for being here and for talking to me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rasha. It's so lovely to be talking to you.
It's so, so nice. As I mentioned earlier in my introduction, the format of this podcast usually is a different one that we're doing today. Usually I invite female writers to bring another writer, female writer with them to introduce her work and talk a little bit about the inspiration so that we talk about someone else's work and then maybe subsequently how it inspires us. But today we're going to do something different for various reasons. You are the editor and curator of an anthology that has just been published by McSweeney's Publishing, and it's called I Know What's Best for You, Stories of Reproductive Freedom. And it's, as the title suggests, about the question of reproductive freedom, which has been recently severely threatened, especially in the US, but also otherwise in other countries all over the globe. Reproductive freedom for women has been severely endangered. So, and also because, incidentally, you invited me to contribute to this book, so we thought this might be a great idea to introduce the book, to introduce you also as a writer slash activist, but also talk about this issue a little bit, which has been very hot in the media the last week. And to start us off, I was wondering if you could, because obviously you're in the US, I'm in Germany, and the legal situations are very different. And we've been reading a lot about the situation in the US and our media as well. But I was thinking maybe you could just very briefly introduce to us what exactly is Roe v. Wade, which we've been reading about, and what exactly does it mean that it has been overturned? How is it important? And maybe just very briefly for people who might not know about it.
Yeah, happily. And I'd love to also ask you a little bit of the same question about Germany later on, even though it is, as you mentioned, part of this project. Your piece is part of this project, but I will admit that I still, with all the different countries represented in the international supplement of the book, which I'm sure we'll explain more about, I still have huge gaps in knowledge, and I'm always very curious to hear about that. And I will also say that a lot of preambles before I get to answering your question, but I will also say there's a way in which we are honoring the format of your podcast, because arguably I have brought with me, you know, about, I don't know, 50, 60 female writers.
That is true.
Between these two anthologies and the supplement, I think it's like something like 70 different writers who are participating and have arrived in the form of these books to this podcast with me. So I'm happy for all of that. You know, it's so interesting because it's not a question for obvious reasons that I've been doing a lot of interviews and podcasts in the last few weeks and have never had to actually say, well, what is Roe v. Wade? It's a Supreme Court decision that was passed almost 50 years ago that essentially guaranteed as a constitutional right, made the right to abortion a constitutional right in the US. And so overturning it means that that states now have the right to decide for themselves. And so at least in the immediate and near future, what it means is that in some states, abortion will be legal and in others, it will not be. What that will look like, it's certainly going to be a shit show, which I hope is a term I can use on this podcast, if we're okay with.
Happily. We're okay. Happy with cursing, okay. So and with strong more, language.
A lot more strong language where that came from is in my throat and in my heart these days.
Honestly, I think with topics like this, we have to. It's not even an option to not, you know, to sort of beat around the bush and use polite language, because if I may say so, the other side doesn't either, you know, so why should we be nicer?
Yeah, it feels almost inappropriate and dishonest to use, as you say, polite language. Yeah, I was actually making that point. I did an event on Zoom last night with a few of the book's contributors, and the writer Devil and Unferth was talking about her anger and just how angry she's been. And I think she was sort of a little bit trying to unpack it, like, you know, the different feelings that come up and how interesting it is that for her, it's been really rage this time around since Friday. And it just made me think, like listening to Deb talk about it, it made me think about how beautiful, how powerful, how important it is for women to be angry, to be publicly angry, to be unashamed and of their anger and sort of presenting it in this way, in this moment. And I think in a way, in contrast to my, especially last night and since Friday's decision, it actually made me really sad and quiet, which as you know, since we know each other, is not an adjective people usually would use to describe my presence
it's
in the world.
Not.
Right. But I've been feeling kind of quiet and sad, quiet for me, I should say, and sad. And so there was this contrast in this Zoom event between, you know, between our energies. And I was just thinking like, Deb, is that like, that's so beautiful. Like, I want to channel my rage, which I'm sure very soon I will again. It's just, we don't control, I think, how we respond to these difficult moments. No idea what I was saying. Oh, I was explaining Roe, and I was trying to explain what it's going to look like in this moment. So I don't know how much sort of minutia and specific details you want us to go into, but essentially some states have something called trigger laws, which just mean basically they were like good to go, ready to hit the ground running. The moment Roe is overturned, they legally are sort of ready to have abortion banned. Of course, now abortion activists are trying to litigate those trigger laws in all of these states. We're already seeing different results in different states. So, you know, that goes to the judicial system in each of these states. So, as I said, a shit show. It's overall predicted that about in the next few months, about 26 states will ban abortion to varying degrees. Mm. Most of them, I think, to considerable degrees. And so, you know, that's a good also moment maybe to mention that our McSweeney's partner in this book, in this project, is an organization called the Bridget Alliance that are a service that helps plan and fund travel for pregnant people across the country who need to travel for abortion, which is now obviously in the, I mean, it's, they exist because this has been the reality, which we could talk more about. So Roe getting overturned doesn't kind of invent a problem. It exacerbates a thousand times fold a problem that has been in existence in American life and in an escalating pattern for quite a while. And yet, as I said, this it has just gotten so much worse. And so it has felt so important to me in sort of talking about this book and doing touring with it and doing events and stuff to kind of really talk about Bridget and organizations like Bridget specifically. There's so many good organizations in general and nonprofits in this field that do all kinds of really important work. But my heart is, well, obviously also because we collaborated with them. And so I got to know them and I know just how hard they work. And so it's a personal connection, but also I think specifically organizations that do this aspect of the work within reproductive freedom and the fight for reproductive rights travel, like in the US, that is sort of, I've been saying for months now, it's the future. Of course, it's very much the present and has now become even more so, meaning this exacerbated, far worse reality that I was referring to is in our future in the last few months is obviously now has become our present. Did I sort of answer your question?
Yes, you did. You did. No, okay. You did. I mean, I guess most people will know it anyway, because it has actually been very prominent in our German media as well. And mm-hmm. it's been hard to escape. And I was just thinking that maybe someone doesn't know. And because we throw around this term Roe v. Wade and everything. So it's like, okay, so what is it actually and what does it mean? And there was a little bit of an, I don't even know what to call it, if it was ironic or sad. On the same day, I think I even texted you this, that Roe got overturned, which was on Friday, I think. We're recording this a couple of days later. We have in Germany an amendment to a section. It's the abortion section of our constitutional law is section 218. It's called the abortion section, and it has an amendment section 219A. And it's sort of a Nazi era law that prohibits doctors from, they say advertising, but basically informing patients and prospective people who might want to seek an abortion about their possibilities. Like, they're not even allowed to put it on their websites, and they it's a punishable offense to, has been a punishable offense to put it even on their websites of doctors, of their practices, to say, by the way, we would provide abortion care. And on the same day that Roe got overturned, this law got overturned finally. So now, I mean, this is something people have been campaigning for ages and ages. So now doctors are actually allowed to advertise to say, by the way, if need be, you can come here.
And to identify themselves as abortion caregivers, right? Yeah, like now are allowed to say that.
Exactly. I mean, I'm guessing that they would have been allowed before, like in patients' conversation, whatever. Mm. It wasn't prohibited because abortion is. And this is like a really interesting thing, because prior to, which is something I'm sure we're going to talk about later, prior to you inviting me to be part of this project, I have to say, I never really even thought too much about this issue, because like you also, I don't have any children and I'm not super sure I ever even wanted any. Mm-hmm. So, and I never have been in the situation that I might like seriously might have had to seek an abortion. I always use birth control. So I sort of had to read up what is the actual situation, the legal situation in Germany. And it was super interesting to me to dive into it, because, you know, you grow up here and you think, oh, yeah, of course, it's legal until the 12th week, you know, and you can go to a doctor and you know that there is this thing that you have to have an informative conversation in a state-funded place. You know, I'm guessing it's something like Planned Parenthood in the US. It's just, you know, some sort of office that informs you of your options, and it's called in German it's called Aufklärungsgespräch, which, you know, just sort of informs you and 3 days prior to your appointment. But what I found out then is that this has only been legal since the early 90s. And that before that, abortion was not legal. And that it has
at all?
It has only in cases of violence and in case of medical issues that would either put the mother or the child in danger. And what I also found out, which is, again, I mean, only if you're familiar with German history, super interesting, it had only had to be renegotiated by the Bundesgerichtshof, by our national court, after the reunification. Because in the Federal Democratic Republic of Germany, in Eastern Germany, it was legal since the 70s. Abortion was.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, and so when the countries reunited, it was like, okay, so we are, you know, it's allowed here and it's not allowed there. So what are we going to do? And then they renegotiated this amendment that, you know, abortion will be legalized, but only under the premise that you get this sort of paper that says, okay, 3 days prior, I was at this conversation. And also it's a non-punishable offense, actually, legally, to get an abortion. Like you cannot
at any stage.
Yes.
At any stage of pregnancy, it's not non-punishable. Wow.
Yes. That's so like, but it's, I mean, it's not punishable. It's not going to go on your record, but it sort of has like it morally judges you that you should be aware that you're actually breaking the law, you know, even if you're not going to get back. So that, I mean, I've been trying to sort of find someone to explain this to me because as someone who doesn't, you know, I'm not really
An expert.
Exactly. Right, exactly. Expert. Mm-hmm. It was just really interesting to me anyway. So now this is like,
am I understanding you correctly? Mm. So I understand that this changed in the 90s and now I understand why. But so the way it is and has been since the 90s is that abortion is technically only legal until the 12th week of pregnancy.
Yes.
And after that, it is technically illegal.
Exactly.
But in reality, it is available to women and it's non-punishable.
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think it's only legal until the 12th week. And after that, only in case of an emergency or if, you know, medical reasons or whatever. I think if you're choosing an abortion, even if you're able-bodied, whatever, you know, and if this is not the result of a rape, you know, if you don't have any reason whatsoever, I think after the 12th week, you're not legally allowed. And doctors are not legally allowed to perform it. So, until week 12.
That's interesting because that's still, you know, that's still really early for a lot of women. I mean, it is true. I know that from statistics, at least here, most abortions do happen earlier than that. I believe at least, I think the statistics I was reading were referencing 15 weeks because that was a cutoff in the Dobbs case, the Mississippi case. It just ended up overturning Roe v. Wade. The initial sort of, you know, conflict, or I don't know, I'm no legal expert either.
Yeah.
So that's definitely not the right terminology, but the legal argument was around, surrounding 15 weeks of pregnancy, which is what Mississippi tried to do. And which was with, total contradiction to Roe, and which is why they, ended up went all the way up to the Supreme Court. But so I think that's the statistic I was reading, that it is true that most pregnancies, which of course doesn't, there's still most, and then whatever the other number on that is still a huge number of women in reality every year. Yeah, that do need abortion for various reasons later on. And 12 is even earlier than that. I think for a lot of women, especially from thinking of like young women and women who are under the burden of low income circumstances, like often people just don't even notice that they skipped a period. If they're like super overworked, if your body is just such that it skips periods sometimes, it could definitely take you 2 to even notice that happened. And, you know, so 12 weeks is still, hey, Germany, what you gonna do about that? That's still really early.
Honestly, I have to say it's really interesting for me to have been diving into this because it's so on the margins, even here in the collective like media representation. I mean, partly because there's so many other shitty things that we have to care about that it's like, okay, so there can be abortions under certain, you know, circumstances. Right. So let's just not even talk about it, except for this amendment that I mentioned earlier. But right. once I started to read up on it and I started to think about it, it's like, yeah, like you said, 12 weeks is really, you know, it's not a lot of time. And then when you mm-hmm. factor in all the structural difficulties that you mm-hmm. might face, which is that fewer and fewer facilities even provide abortions, simply because it's like in our healthcare system all in all is really shitty,
right.
which we saw right. during COVID.
Right.
It's like, so you have to get an appointment at one of these places where you can get the paper that you had the conversation. And after that, you have to find a doctor who's going to perform an abortion for you. And so this already can take.
And meanwhile, the clock is ticking. Yeah.
Exactly. And then also, again, it, like with everything, it depends on where you live. Do you live in a big city which, you know, gives you more options, obviously, like in every other place? Or are you in some rural area where, you know, mm-hmm. there is nobody, you know, or you have to travel, like you also said, you know, five, 6 hours to the next bigger city. And then, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I feel like, I mean, I'm by no means an expert whatsoever on the campaigns that go on in this country in this issue, partly also because my main focus in my work is also like racism and everything. And it's really, mm-hmm. it's been really interesting to think about, like when I was prepping for our conversation today and I reread so many of the pieces in your book, and I realized that something was happening to me, you know, in my thought also. I'm sure we can go into this later, but I mean, let's just sort of dive into your book, because so in response to this whole situation, your book comes out. And I mean, in a really weird time frame that it just sort of, I mean, you and I, we both know, and people in publishing, I'm sure all of them, that books don't just appear. It's like they just so materialize.
I wish to live in a world where books could appear.
That would be a
lovely world.
You know, so
let me know if you find the keys.
I know, I've been looking for it, believe me. But so it just happens that it just comes here. But I mean, I remember that you told me already, like I think a year ago or something, or even earlier than that, that Roe was going to get overturned. So this was, you know, this was sort of the buzz and basically a fact that you guys in the US knew would happen. So can you talk to me a little
Some
bit about
people did.
Yeah. Yeah, just can you talk to me a little bit about how this project came about, this how, you know, I know you got invited to do it, but maybe you can sort of elaborate a little bit how it happened and how it happened that it just comes in this very moment that it's on the bookshelves.
Yeah, for sure. So I can start by saying about the timing. Yeah, I think I do remember that conversation you and I had about a year ago. I did, and I'm certainly not alone in that, and I'm no prophet by any means. I do think a lot of other people had thought it was pretty clear that Roe was either going to be completely overturned, which has been my belief for a long time now, considering the makeup of the Supreme Court, thanks to President Trump, former President Trump. And at the same time,
maybe
that
future this, President Trump. I mean,
don't even. Yeah, exactly. And you know, that I think most people had clarity that even in the event that it was not going to be completely overturned, it was going to be handicapped to the point where de facto it will be, and the you know, reality on the ground, which I alluded to earlier, has been so difficult for a long time now. There was no way in which this Supreme Court ruling wasn't going to make that far worse. So that I do think most people knew. I'm clarifying and qualifying a little bit, because I do think a lot of people are experiencing shock. The first kind of wave of shock was when the initial draft of the decision was leaked a couple months ago. Certainly then, and now there's another wave. And I'm hearing that from a lot of people, a lot of women in particular, but a lot of people of all genders who are in a lot of pain and are experiencing shock. And those of them who are close to me, I do yell at them a little bit. Like, what have I been telling you?
Yeah, I know the feeling.
Yeah, because this has been such a huge part of my life for 3 years. And I have been telling people a lot about this as I was learning more, because it's not like I knew much more before I was invited to helm this project. I thought I did, you know, as sort of the queer feminist writer based in Brooklyn, like I tend to always think I know at least an average amount about liberal causes of various kinds, and I often don't.
Yeah, that's the problem with us liberals. Yeah. You know, we always think we know everything, and I think that's really to the detriment of the liberal cause, which is, you know, when you talked about this to me, I felt like, you know, I was reminded of the whole Brexit disaster, because I, you know, it was in the works for so long, and I remember that because Brexit happened in the summer of 2016, and I remember in the spring of 2015, a friend of mine who then used to work in London in the bank, she said Brexit's going to happen, you know, like matter of fact, she said Brexit's going to happen, and I was like, nah, no way this is going to happen, you know, Europe and everything. And then, you know, 1.5 years later, you know, you wake up to this news, it's like, oh my god, it's actually true. So sorry I interrupted you. Please
continue. No, not at all. I think you're right, it's an interesting thing to think about. Is it a liberal problem? I think we're also just now in this exchange between us maybe conflating two things that I want to keep distinct, which is the sort of optimism that at least often, obviously, in the course of history, but specifically in the times we're living in, has proven unwarranted so often. I don't have that for whatever reason, probably having to do with growing up in Israel and with all of the criticism that I have of the Israeli government and military and that I've had my whole life. I think that's a big part of why I don't have that brand of optimism. I assume things are going to go very badly. And so, for instance, I mean, I wouldn't say that Trump getting elected wasn't a shock, but it was a shock for all of 5 seconds. And it was only a shock because I've been living in this country, the United States, for now nearly going on 20 years next year. And in part because I believed that this home was less problematic than my other home. And I think it just took me those 5 seconds to accept the fact that both of these countries that I love so much both have these complex histories and these ailments really at the core of them, that it was just hard for me to come to terms with that. So that was a huge, huge long aside and not what you're asking, but I'm just saying there's the optimism, the liberal optimism that is sometimes unwarranted, as I've said, and there's just thinking you know shit when you don't, which is also just a specific problem, a Shelley problem more than a liberal problem, is the one I was presenting in this conversation. But maybe it's also a liberal one. And certainly, again, I'm connecting to my Israeli identity. I think it's a common Israeli problem. So for all of these reasons, point is, I thought I knew stuff. And then I was invited to take on this project and just started talking to the women who co-founded the Bridget Alliance, started reading a lot more about it and researching some, and really realized like how little I had known, because I didn't actually know back then. This is 2019. We were really already in a state of acute crisis in terms of reproductive freedom. And, you know, that year alone, I think it's something close to 50 laws in about 20 states restricting abortion passed. Yeah, that's a lot. And so, that's, you know, that's where I'm sort of like, there's a part of me kind of yelling at the people in my life who are shocked now. And then there's a part of me really wanting to have empathy and compassion, because I also know that feeling. We can't always be tapped into all of the causes, especially these days in the world. There's so much that needs our attention. There's so much that as moral people, we expect ourselves to be tapped into, to fight for and against, to do. And the reality is that we can't do all the things all the time. So I do have a lot of compassion for women and people of all genders who maybe fought other battles during this time and kind of let that one be, and are really hit hard right now in sort of coming to terms with the reality in terms of abortion rights in this country. So I do also have a lot of empathy for that. To actually answer your question, I, as you alluded to earlier, curated and edited a different anthology for McSweeney's called Indelible in the Hippocampus Writings from the Me Too Movement, which was a project that started literally days, I think something like 4 or 5 days after the Harvey scandal broke back in 2017. And as you mentioned, because books, and as I talk about a little bit in my foreword to this new anthology, books are slow, they come into our world slowly, et cetera. So we started working on it in 2017, it came out in 2019, a lot of quote unquote Me Too books were coming out at that time for this reason. It takes about 2 years if you're fast to put a book together and publish it, at least in the States. That's kind of like the timeline.
Yeah, it's the same here.
Sometimes, yeah. I know in some countries, I think we're publishing is just like a smaller endeavor. It could happen quickly. I believe in Israel, it's quicker. I believe I have an Icelandic friend who's a writer. I believe there it's a little bit quicker. But anyway, in the States, that's approximately what it is. It can be done faster. It's just, it needs to be like a huge book that there's, you know, the resources behind it to make it all happen quickly. But generally that's the timeline. With Indelible, we moved pretty quickly and it still, you know, still took 3 years. This time, I think our initial intention was to move even faster. And of course, COVID happened a few months into our starting to work on this project. And it ended up being about 3 years. So I was, I believe, right about to go on tour, coming back from tour with Indelible, something around that time. So the fall of 2019, when Amanda Yulee, who's McSweeney's publisher, told me that she had been having these conversations with Carol Davis, who's the woman who had co-founded the Bridget Alliance, about this potential collaboration. An anthology that they were sort of thinking of as potentially similar in format and spirit to Indelible and Hippocampus, which is a multi-genre book. So with Indelible, you know, it felt important to me for reasons that I think initially I couldn't even fully articulate, but I just felt in my bones important to make it a multi-genre book, and it's fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. And so they were thinking about putting a book together that would be sort of in the same spirit and format, and asked if I would take that on. And that's when I started working on that project. And so one of the first kind of thoughts that I had, I was around that time having a lot of conversations about Indelible, and in a bunch of interviews, I was asked why multi-genre? Because, you know, as you know, and you can tell me if it's the same in Germany or not, but here I think often when anthologies come out in response to social causes or social crisis or injustice, they do tend to be nonfiction anthologies. Mm. And so even with Indelible, even though multi-genre is what the book is, it's in the language about the book, it's everywhere, and still often, either if someone noticed it, they would always ask about it. If they didn't notice it, they would always make the assumption that it was essays. And so then I would have to correct and say, actually, it's essays and fiction and poems.
Yeah. Can I just briefly, because I mean, with the multi-genre, I was going to talk about it anyway later, but now we're already into it. It's just, I personally feel that the multi-genre thing makes it so much stronger in every aspect than if it would have been only personal essays, you know, nonfiction. And I think you're right. I think it's similar here, that either it's just short fiction or and like classic short fiction, you know, and or personal essays. Rarely I feel even those mix. With Indelible already, but also with this one now, you go even further, you know, you have poetry, you have a play or a couple of plays, I guess, which actually one of them is one of my favorite texts in the book. I wrote the title down here. Hang on. It's the anti-fairy tales from the feminine book of Fuck This.
Kate Parker. Yep.
This is like a personal thing, I guess, but I think I sometimes I really admire pieces where I feel I could never ever do this, you know. It's because, you know, I write classic, you know, novels, fiction, essays. I've been getting better and better at, but I mean, I tried my hand at poetry when I was younger, and that was probably really bad. But a play, and especially because it's also, I mean, it's deep, but it's also really evil, but also really funny. And these are all aspects that I really admire, because I don't think I'm ready to do that. I'm not sure why, but this is like a different conversation.
I have to jump in and say, it's so interesting. I think when a writer just is like touched by God, I can say that in a more secular way, which would be touched by the universe is more aligned with my own tendencies. But just to say, when a writer has that kind of brilliance, and I think Kate Tarker does, a playwright of this piece/these pieces, it was originally, she sent it to me as three plays, and I was like, do not force me to choose. I love all three of them. Will you work with me to make them work as one piece? And she was like, okay, let's do it. So that's why it's one play, but originally it was three plays, and you can sort of very obviously very much see that. Like, we made it work as one thing, but it's very clearly three pieces that are distinct. When a writer has whatever that magic sauce is that Kate Tarker does, it's just always inspiring to people, because I was listening to you, and for the exact opposite reason, I have the exact same experience. So for me, it's because I love plays and writing plays. It's because Kate is similar to what I love, what I think, you know, at my best, I love doing on the page. So what it's like the exact opposite, and I have the exact same response as you, which is like, this is just so inspiring to me. Like, this just makes me so happy to read and receive, makes me happy that it exists in the world without having even anything to do with me. It's just this boost of happiness and inspiration that these pieces give me. And I think that's the uniqueness of just really of some great writers.
I mean, I have the same feeling in with pieces that, you know, genres that I do work in, when I feel like it's that's really brilliant. And, you know, it's similar, exactly. To, you know, like, I mean, now we're like going all over the place, but the piece you have in the book, I mean, you have one story in it, but you also have a piece, it's pretty much in the middle of the book, where you exchange letters with a friend of yours. And for some reason that really, like, I mean, I was trying to think, did this resonate with me so much because I know you know, because that sometimes it's hard to sort of
sift through
apart, you know, is it because you know someone, or is it because, but then again, I feel like it's also connected because there's a reason why we know each other and why we're friends, because you know, obviously something with our souls, whatever, our intellect, you know, resonates. So that deeply resonated with me, and I feel like this is something I could have done also with, you know, this could have been something I could have written with you or with another friend anyway. So but before we go into that, let's just sort of like go back to the more general thing of the book as well. You already sort of mentioned that it took roughly 2 years to put it together. It is a convolute of like 400 plus pages, so that is a lot. How did you go about selecting these writers? And because I know that you invited them, but like, are these all people you know, you admire the work, or are these people, I was wondering if, because I don't know any of them, like I didn't know any of their names before, is this part of their work, or are some of them, you know, is this center to their work, thinking about reproductive freedom? I think also we should mention that this is not an abortion book. I think this is really, really important, that this is not a book about abortion. So yeah, maybe you can expand on that a little, like, how do you select the writers? And also like the fact that so this much. Is not an abortion book, you know, I mean.
Yeah, so much there to unpack. I think I'll actually start by rewinding a little bit to your previous question and kind of connecting by saying, you know, about the multi-genre aspect. When I was first invited to make this book, and I was still at that point doing these interviews about Indelible and being asked about the multi-genre and finding myself making the case for a multi-genre book, and at the same time starting to figure out what is my vision for this anthology, then I had to say, well, if I'm making such a point about multi-genre and why it matters, then let's really do it. Then let's make it more multi-genre. And that's where I connect to what you were rightly observing, that this book is even more. So it's fiction, nonfiction, and poetry like Indelible. But on top of that, it has three plays, it has photography, and it has a comic, which certainly made me very, very happy to have Erin Williams and Kate Novotny's comic in there. And later, and we'll talk surely more about that, but later when I started curating the international supplement, it became very important just to my kind of anal mind to make sure that we have the same diversity of genres exactly in the supplement. So we also have a comic in the supplement, we have photography in the supplement, we have a theater piece, and we have fiction, nonfiction, and poetry in the international supplement, which we should say is called I Know What's Best For You All Over the World. And since I'm saying a word about that, I'll also say, to all book buyers, you get for free the ability to download the supplement as an ebook to your preferred device. And in addition to that, if you don't need it as one ebook, which most people like, and that's why it's nice to have that option. But if that's not a thing for you in your life, then you just go to the McSweeney's website and type in, I Know It's Best For You All Over the World, and you'll be taken to the project's page and be able to read all the pieces.
Yeah, we're gonna put links in the description of the podcast later. Wonderful. Also, of course, and also because we made sure of that before, that the book is actually available in Germany to at least order, you know, from your local bookstore. Anyone can order it from their bookshop, and it's going to be available here, so you don't have to.
Yes, and I think we have
travel
a list
to the
of
US
bookstores. Mm-hmm, right. I think we have a list of bookstores in Germany.
Yes.
Where you can order the book that I'm sure, Russia, you'll put.
Yes, I'll put all later. Of this. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay. So that was sort of my kind of tying back and connecting to this next question. And I'm like, wait, remind me. I feel like there was three questions in that question.
Like, how did you select
right,
the writers? How did you curate it? I mean, I guess that's a super hard question, especially when it's...
No, not at all. No, I've been answering it a ton.
You've been answering it all the time.
I've been answering it a lot. Happy to talk about it. I just vaguely remember that there was another thread or two to the question that I may have dropped, but you'll tell me in a moment.
I will.
So basically... we couldn't put what, at least in the US, is you know, would be referred to as a call out. We couldn't, meaning just like invite anyone who wants to submit, because McSweeney's, while a small independent publisher, also a very well known and respected publisher. And had we done that, we would have gotten a huge volume of submissions that, you know, that all comes to resources that would have been more demanding than me and the team of people working on this book could handle, really. So yes, it was, as you kind of correctly guessed, it was me extending invitations. I think I reached out to somewhere between 100 and 110, something like that, writers and artists whose work I admired. I think it's like, just like I wouldn't recognize most names of very well-known writers in Germany. So I think that's probably why I would say, people sort of in writing circles here would recognize between 70 to 80% of this list. Some are sort of newer voices, and that was very important to me to include that in the book for sure. So there's certainly a number of writers who kind of fit that subcategory. And they're also just, when you're in a book like that, when you're working on a book like that and you're having a ton of conversations about these topics, then you come across all kinds of stories. And so, for instance, we have the essay about surrogacy in the book, and that person is not someone who, at least until now, I believe, identified as a writer. Certainly she hasn't published or I don't believe tried to ever. And so she's just a friend of a writer friend of mine, because, you know, through conversations about this, and someone might end up saying like, oh, and this is where we connect. Now I'm remembering that part of your question was about the fact that it's not an abortion book, but rather a reproductive freedom book. And I can say more about that, but so that is what it is. So I'm having these conversations about different aspects of reproductive freedom with many, many people. And so things like that come up, like, oh, I know this person who had this really interesting experience. Would that be of interest to you? And in that case, I sort of took it on to kind of work with Carrie Bornstein, the writer of that essay, to see if we could shape a piece that would fit in the book. And we did, and I'm so happy that it's part of the book. Or Aaron Williams, who I mentioned earlier, who has the comic in the book, ended up saying, you know, I want to collaborate on this piece with a doula, and that's Kate Novotny, who's her collaborator on the piece, is someone who I think primarily works as a doula. And so we've ended up in this way. There are a couple more examples that I won't list here, but they're in this way. There's like a really interesting, oh, there's Yael Shinar, is someone who I've known for a long time, who's a doctor and a poet. Mm. So, you know, there's that kind of doctor's perspective in the book. So in different ways, we ended up kind of with these perspectives that I think felt important and interesting and kind of enriching to the book as a whole. As far as the reproductive freedom, the sort of wider approach, I can say that in a way that question alone could be a whole podcast. So I'll spare everyone of my full answer to that question. But I will just say, yes, that felt very important to me for a bunch of reasons. And so my approach was both to think about what are the different aspects of reproductive freedom. So fertility and contraception and surrogacy and child freeness and of course abortion, and really kind of telling, inviting writers and artists to define their own, what is reproductive freedom to them? What aspect do they connect with within the topic? And then I also kind of made a list of just aspects of life in general and life in America in particular that I believe intersect and interact with reproductive freedom in ways that are important to spotlight. And so that's racism in America. That's also climate change. That's disability and the underrepresentation of disability. Those are some examples that were sort of on my initial list. And those texts were in my initial invitation to writers and artists. Like, here's how I'm thinking of this topic. Definitely abortion, but not only, all these different aspects and also intersections and interactions between those topics and these other aspects of life. And so I kind of invited slash nudged people, but to explore, to make pieces with all of that in mind, but never in a particular direction, like creativity, the freedom, you know, not to overuse that word, but truly that's what it was. It would be sort of ridiculous and absurd to then limit in a book and in a project about freedom to be creatively limiting or rigid would be absurd. So it also felt very important to me to just say, hey, this is what we're doing. It's actually super wide and open and creative, and you can do your own thing within that. And then I would never say to any writer, I prefer this genre from you, or I prefer this topic from you. I just was sort of then waiting to see what happens. Here I'm tying a little bit back to the other question. Out of those 110 that I had conversations with, we ended up getting, I would say, between 60 to 65 pieces. You know, definitely some people, especially a bunch of men, I have to say, who I admire, who identify as liberals, even feminists in many cases, who said I definitely will support the book, and many have, but told me, you know, I don't know as a writer that I have much to say on this. Which, on the one hand, I have respect for any writer anytime that says this, I can't make work on this topic. It's a right we all have and should have, so I totally respect that. And at the same time, that it was sad to me, and it was surprising to me that this happened so much.
Yeah.
I ended up having two male writers, two cis male writers in the book, and I certainly wanted initially to have a couple more, and it was really hard. And so that is interesting to me, and kind of showed me, I think, something that I hope is now changing with this new ruling. But that in general, I don't know that cis men have put kind of their power and privilege behind this fight in a full way. I do think there's a way in which they don't know what to do with themselves in this particular landscape. They feel like it's, you know, not their place necessarily.
Their fight to fight also.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm being critical, I would say not their fight to fight. If I'm being more generous, I would say I think they just feel like they're supposed to not take space or not speak up on something that's that they're privileged not to experience with their own physical bodies if they're cis men. So
but
whatever
also,
the truth
I mean,
is,
can I interrupt you just really briefly? Do you also feel like sometimes, I mean, I would have so much to say about this. I think this would be a never ending podcast if we just sort of went all the different directions that we already like sort of cast out.
We have been known to have 10 hour
conversations. I know so we do. So anyone listening now, you're totally free to switch off because, you know.
This is just that we're really going to talk to them for 10 hours. No, that's
this is just like
recording.
Shelley's and my party here now. Let's get a glass of wine. Welcome to our party. there are a few things. For example, one thing when I started advertising this episode that we're going to put online soon with you and I, one of the women who's following, she got really excited because she's very agitated about this whole topic, and said, just put out this question, I really wonder when men will recognize female rights as human rights. It's just this really like, okay, so when is this actually going to happen? And then at the same time, and this is like more of a writerly thing, which I mean, I would really hope to talk about also a little bit later, is that, for example, over here, we have at the moment a huge division. Between male and female writers on the one hand and critics, you know, that there's the, you know, a few years ago when there were people in Germany, you know, white people in Germany were discovering, oh my God, people of migrational background, they can actually write. Wow, you know, this is incredible. And so, you know, and this is only like 5 or 6 years ago. So, I mean, hello, Germany. I love you so much. So now it's suddenly this whole thing that, you know, and you got, I used to get a lot of aggression. Then it's like, oh, so yeah, I don't, I'm not Turkish. I'm not Arab. I'm not whatever. So obviously I'm not going to get reviewed. So it's like, you know, boring. And now it's the same with female writers and female issues in fiction and male critics. Having said that, like, for example, a few months ago, a good friend of mine put out a novel, which I think is absolutely excellent. It's one of the best books I read recently. And it's like very subtly exploring all kinds of violence women experience. And it's not in this like sort of on the nose kind of way where women get beat up or murdered, but just like the day-to-day microaggressions. She also has one of the main characters, she's seeking IVF and it's not working. So this is also sort of in the realm of the book. And she describes a scene which just makes me already cringe when I think about it, where the character is in the office of the doctor who you know, does her treatment, and he basically tells her, or he has to tell her now that, oh yeah, okay, so this is now I don't know how many rounds now and it's not going to work. And so she describes from the female perspective that the female, that this woman who's sitting there and who's getting this devastating news that she's probably not going to be a mother, which is something she really craves, has the responsibility, or feels the responsibility, to console the doctor, because she feels like he's about to say, oh, don't you cry, you know, like you say to a little girl, oh, don't you cry, you know. It's an, and that, you know, and so this sort of weird power shift where he should be the empathetic and responsible one as a doctor also, but also as the one who's not receiving the news, you know, because it's her, you know, it's mm-hmm. her feeling,
her life.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And her dream, and for her, you know, what she wants for her life. And this scene is just, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps as I'm talking about it, because it's so intense and it's really short and really condensed. So this book comes out anyway, and I kid you not, none of the male reviewers even picked up on these issues.
Oh wow.
It's so, I mean, it's infuriating mm-hmm. that, and it's so clear when you look at it, also when you see the readers, that every single woman is picking up on it, you know, on everything mm-hmm. and all the like violence and all the aggression and everything. And and none of the male critics are. They're like, mm-hmm. okay, so this is about, you know, so this couple moves from the big city to the rural area, so maybe it's about that, you know, that kind of thing. It's
oh god,
it's so
are I there think, are most critics male in Germany, like are there no female critics?
No, they are, but I'm guessing that, you know, as in, I mean, we talked about this so many times. It's like, this is a very small country. And the bubble of the, you know, what is deemed the elite in criticism is, again, according to this small country, also very, very small. And naturally, I guess, most of these people who are deemed important are male, because they've been in their seats for decades, you know, because once mm-hmm. they're in their seat, they will not let go. And it just takes time for a generation of women to grow into it. And so you have all these male critics and female also, but they're all in their 60s and over, you know. So obviously this is not like the perspective that, you know, you can feel that there's, I mean, it's an interesting time for so many reasons, mm-hmm. I feel, as much as it's scary. But like for the first time, I noticed there's so much friction between this generation, which has grown up, you know, in this sort of, because this is the generation, this is post-war in Europe, you know, this is mm-hmm. not the generation like mm-hmm. my grandparents, but more my mother's generation, who's in her mid-60s. So they grew mm-hmm. up in peacetime. They grew up in prosperity, and supposedly with no problems, you know, because they were all told, oh, what are you even have to whine about? Because, you know, it's peace. And now, you know, all this young generation comes up and they talk about racism. They talk about mm-hmm. gender issues. They talk about climate all the time, you know, and so you feel this old generation is like, what the fuck is happening? And in response, they get so much more aggressive in every aspect, like in every decision, in every critique, in every essay they write. So it's a very aggressive time, I feel, but also interesting, you know, to put a book out
it's
like
so
this.
So interesting. Also. I feel the same sort of generational gap and kind of awareness of social causes, both in here in the US and back home for me in Israel. I feel that that, and there's a part of me being like, well, that's every generation. Like when you're in your 30s, your 40s, you look at people in their 60s or 70s and you're like, what is wrong with you? How are you not seeing? So there's a way in which we're not doing anything new. But I do wonder, I've had this thought often of, you know, with technology, with reality kind of speeding up into becoming something new, a new version of itself that's quite different. And we do know that that has sped up. That is a process in the last 100 years has sped up. So I do wonder if those things are connected, if the other process too of the sort of psychological, mental shift in response to our changing environment has also sped up. And if that in turn in some way deepened the gap, the generational gap, which is why we're feeling it so acutely. And the truth is that you kind of can't assume, which I think is what you were alluding to, you can't assume that a woman in her 60s or 70s, I know many of them that do share my politics and they're amazing. So it is possible to be, but you kind of can't assume that in the way that you would in certain circles in certain cities. Like if I'm meeting a writer in Brooklyn, I can safely assume that who's around my age or younger, I can safely assume that we share a particular way of looking at the world, a particular sensitivity to certain things, an understanding of how to use or not use pronouns, how to make certain assumptions or not, like all of those things that you can't just assume with older people. But yeah, we're totally on the side.
We're drifting off. I mean, I would also say that it has something to do, obviously, with the way communication works nowadays. Like when I was younger, when I was like in my late teens and 20s, I had no voice because I couldn't make my voice heard, you know, because there was no internet as such. We didn't have any social media. So I could obviously like say something to my friends or to my professors at university, but I mean, who the hell would care, you know? So, and nowadays the kids have all these Instagram accounts and TikTok and whatnot, you know? And so they made their voices heard, which I think is amazing. Like I look at them and I'm like, oh my God, I'm so jealous of your generation that you have this outlet or this, you know, possibility to have an outlet. But at the same time, obviously, this invites a huge backlash. So yes. I guess this is where we are. But let's go back to the problem. Exactly.
Yes.
Let's go back to other problems. I mean, there's so many. I mean, let's see if we can save the world today. So anyway, so now you already talked about this a little bit, is the fact that there is an international edition of I Know What's Best For You, or also like footnote. I love the title. I Know What's Best For You. It's just so, do you know what did that come from you or is that, was it? The
no, it did no. not. It came from my dear, dear friend, Diana Speckler, who is an incredible writer and a contributor to the first anthology, to Indelible on the Hippocampus. And basically my personal titler, which is not a word in English, just so you don't think that it's a word you don't know, listeners, or Russia. But I'm very good at titling my own fictions and I love doing it. And I sometimes help others do that. So with fiction, for some reason, I find it a lot easier to just sort of scan a piece for some, usually just a phrase or, you know, a word or something in the text that kind of holds a lot of the meaning of that story. I kind of love that little exercise. I enjoy it and I'm fairly good at it or decent at it. So that's one thing. But when one has to title an essay or more, even more challenging, an anthology.
Yeah.
You kind of can't play that little game of mine. You also don't want to spotlight one piece or one contributor over the others, but also it just kind of doesn't work. We talked about the scope of this book. It's an insane scope. It's a, you know, it really is such a vast, broad project that is doing so much. So it felt so impossible to me to scan the text for like the one word that would hold a meaning. I knew that wasn't the right approach. That's generally when I turn to Diana. She's just very good with this sort of thing. But I have to say this time around, she struggled too. We have a little WhatsApp group with another friend who's the writer, Alison Espach, who's also in this book. And I think you in earlier conversations alluded to her story as one of the ones. So that's the story that, is second, I believe, in the book about the woman whose husband is dying.
That is such a great story.
Yeah, it's such a great story. Incredible writer. her own book, Notes on Your Sudden Disappearance, just came out around the same time of the anthology. Mm-hmm. So she and I have been doing a lot of events together. She's truly a remarkable writer. But so anyway, the three of us have a WhatsApp thread in which we went back and forth about the title, potential titles for the anthology. And it was very hard. You know, this, after Indelible in the Hippocampus, which is very sort of intentionally a mouthful. And I love that about it. We can talk more about that title is essentially a quote from the Christine Blasey Ford, Dr. Ford's testimony in the Kavanaugh hearings. So that's what that's in reference to. The Kavanaugh hearings happened when I was kind of midway through editing Indelible, and it made a lot of, or a few of the contributors kind of edit their pieces with that in mind. Everyone was deeply affected by it. It made one contributor at the time just pull her piece and write a whole new piece in response to the Kavanaugh situation. Wow. So it really affected the book in a deep way. And we ended up kind of titling it in response to that. But I love that title so much, and it's a mouthful. And so originally I wanted something kind of snippy and short for this one. And I, in the very, very early days, I thought choice, just like, I just liked the sort of rhythm of the sound of it, I should say. But this is like before I even started actively curating the book, because very early on when I started just having conversations about the book, I learned that choices become a pretty white word. That for a lot of women of color in this country, where the issue isn't at the time, didn't feel like, so what if I have, like, what choice do I have? If I don't have access, it is a privileged way of thinking about it. And just in terms of rights, and supposedly those rights mean that I have a choice and that's the thing that I'm fighting for, when in reality, I just don't have access. And so in listening to that, I was like, okay, then if we want this sort of punchy effect of one word, then access. But somehow that didn't have the same phonetically as my writer self did respond as well to that. But that was our sort of temporary title for the majority of the life of this project. We, in internal communication, like, it was always access. A lot of the contributors know this. We're always talking about it as access. Never felt totally right to me. And when the moment came to really make the decision, we started really searching for all other things. That's when that WhatsApp thread came to life. And Diana was saying to me, you know, I kept saying to her the point that you, Rasha, made earlier, like, it's not just an abortion book. I want a title that communicates that it's also fertility and contraception. And Diana was like, yeah, all those sexy words that really make a great title, you know, it's really
and
hard.
That really want to make you buy a book also.
exactly. So that's why it was really hard. So we hit a wall several times. But we're, you know, it's just this kind of friendship and WhatsApp group where it's just very hard to keep people focused. Everyone starts cracking jokes all the time.
Yeah.
So mostly this became a forum for like faux mock titles for the book that were never going to work. And I won't quote some of them here, but that's mostly what it became. And every time I would be like, ladies, like, help me. I really need to start the first book.
Be serious.
And then when we did be serious. Try to help me here. And it was really hard. And then the third time we did this, I just remember we kind of again hit a wall, and I was like, oh, it just maybe has to be access. And I just went to pee, and I come out of the restrooms, of the bathroom, and I just see my phone, because this is all text on WhatsApp, and it just said, it's a message from Diana, and it just says, I know what's best for you. And I was amazing. Like, well, then tell me. Like, what is it?
What is it? What do you
mean? And I was like, oh, and I just felt it in my body. Like,
yeah.
Yes, that's the title. I immediately emailed Amanda Yuli, and I was like crossing fingers that she was going to like it. And I just remember she was like on a work trip or something. So it took her like a few hours or until the next day or something. And she and I email like a million times a day. So I was like, oh my God, Amanda doesn't love it. It won't get to be the title. And that day clarified for me even more that that's the right title, because I just needed her to love it. It felt so right to me. I'm so
apparently
grateful to Diana for this title.
I love it so much because it has this implication of power, which is such an important question when it comes to reproductive rights. You know, it's like, who has the power over our bodies, over our uteruses, you know, and is like freedom, you know, freedom and power. What is it even? So I really like it. Also, it really reminds you of, also, you know, when you were younger and your granny would say, I know what's best for you, eat your broccoli,
exactly.
You know, so it's like, it has that little wink, wink thing also going. So yeah,
exactly. I do think in a way to me, that's the power of the title. That's why I felt grateful for it, because it is kind of the common thread from all between all of these different aspects of reproductive freedom. There's always this sort of assumption on the other side that somehow someone knows better for you what is best for you and your reproductive choices.
Yeah.
That's really sort of the main flaw that we're faced with and all of its ramifications. But that's really at the core of the thinking, what's problematic, and all the ways in which that affects women in particular.
Yeah. Let's talk about the international issue.
Yes.
A little bit. Yes. So there is an international supplement, which you already mentioned can be downloaded and can be read online also. How did that sort of manifest for you? Like, at what point did you think, okay, so it's not enough to talk about the US and invite US writers, but I really want to broaden the whole discussion?
I think I was really conflicted about this from the start, because as I shared a little bit with you, the inception story, the book very much started in response to our reproductive crisis here in the US, which, as I cited earlier, was already in such acute state back in 2019 when we started. So it seemed clear to me that this needed to be a response to the crisis in the US. And of course, bring about as many diverse voices as possible within that framework. But the framework was, this is a response to the US crisis. And so it seemed clear and I started proceeding. And then both, I think, because of my own personal history as someone who is binational, because I was born in the US, but grew up in Israel and now have been living and lived in Israel until I was 25, and then have been in the US for quite a while now. So I think that's part of it, but maybe even more so, it just started becoming so clear that, and I think you alluded to a little bit of that earlier, that something was happening around the world with reproductive freedom. And I put it that way, which is very sort of non-writerly, something was happening, but I'm sort of putting it that way, phrasing it that way on purpose, because it's not in one clear direction. Like if I think of, you know, I think I quote some of these statistics, now I have to recite them from memory. So if I mess it up, please fact check me. But I allude to those in the intro to the supplement, that last year alone, I think Mexico decriminalized abortion, Thailand legalized, do I have that right? Thailand, I think, legalized first-term abortion. I think China vowed to reduce the number of abortions, and Poland passed a near total ban, as we know. So I have made, I think that's right. I think I just got it right. Again, you can fact check me, but just to say that's like last year alone.
Yeah.
Like it's just when, if you're sort of a little bit aware of this topic, you keep hearing about it in the news in different places. So, you know, my own kind of perspective as a binational person, this clear movement around the world, it just started to feel wrong that we were only focused and on the US, and yet it was very clear that that is what the book needed to be. So it seemed like an unwinnable, like I just didn't know how to resolve that conundrum. And eventually I just said, maybe we can do something outside of the book that will be a kind of supplement that would spotlight writers from around the world. And really, I have to credit McSweeney's and specifically Amanda Ugly, where I have an idea like that, which of course means a ton of work for everyone and more resources and all this stuff. And she just very quickly was like, okay, yes, I hear you. That's what we need to do then. And so then I went about then curating and editing that. As you know, we have 16 writers and artists in the supplement, including yourself.
Yes, I'm so proud and so honored to be part of it. It's like my personal, for many reasons, it's a personal thing that, you know, it's the first time I actually wrote something in original English that is actually published, mm-hmm. Which is like not translated. And obviously, you and I, we're friends, and I really admire, what you do, and I loved, Indelible and the whole idea behind it and everything. And it just, also it just always feels that whatever you sort of bring to my door is super interesting and just so much more interesting and diverse and in so many ways more mind-bending and more enriching than whatever I get here. It's just, again, we're a very small country, which is incredibly boring and incredibly sort of you know, one dimensional, and the fight to become more multidimensional, not even, you know, it's so tiring sometimes, you know, when you get boxed into certain things, and then, you know, it's just such a breath of fresh air. So just like, yeah, thank you so much again. Anyway, so I interrupted you.
Oh, no, thank you for participating. And I would love to actually talk to you more about that. What I was just going to say is kind of give listeners an idea of the scope of it. So we have pieces from China and India and Afghanistan and Greece and Poland, and Russia's piece represents both Germany and Saudi Arabia. You can say more about that in a moment. And Cameroon in Africa and Israel and Palestine. More and more. I'm going to stop listing countries now. But and as I said earlier, it also represents the same sort of it's as multi-genre as the book. And which, you know, was for whatever reason felt very important to me from a sort of a curatorial perspective. I just wanted that mirroring effect. And as you pointed out, that's not only in your case. I think quite a few writers ended up saying to me, if you would help editorially, if you would support me through this process, I want to try writing in English for the first time. I think for most of the writers who did that, it was their first time doing that. So obviously, like you, they're more than fluent, very fluent in English, but that doesn't mean obviously that one writes in that language. So I have to say that was such an interesting, I felt really lucky to be part of that process because it meant that the piece meant a lot to the writers and that I got to be part of something very meaningful and exciting and creatively sort of new to the writer on the other side. I have to say here, I have to give a ton of credit to Amy Summerton, who's my assistant editor on this project, because this did mean in some cases a ton more editing than we would have done otherwise. And really, I could not have done that without Amy's help. She's brilliant. She helped me she was my assistant editor on the supplement as well as the book. So everything I just said goes to both parts of this project, and I'm really eternally indebted to her. But also we did have some translators. So it was a combination of, in some cases, finding a translator to sort of join and help facilitate, and in other cases, having the writer write in English, which sometimes meant a lot of work and a lot of back and forth on our end, which I was really, really happy to be able to do. And also the work with the translators was interesting. And I have to say, you know, when I describe it that way, it just sounds like so much work and so such an elaborate project. And certainly it was, but I have to say there's a way in which I think that's the magic of the supplement to me, is that it came together a lot more easily than it sounds like. When I say to people 16 countries, when I say some of what these countries are, and it really is from around the globe, when I say there are translators involved in the project, it just sounds, and yes, it was a lot of work, but it sounds like more than it was. There's a way in which it just came through so easily and seamlessly that just felt to me like one of those things where, oh, this thing wants to come into the world. Like I would just find the way I went about it is like, just like you and I know each other from a writer's residency a few years back. So I reached out to you. With a lot of people, I just reached out to someone I knew in a country and just said, could you connect me? Who do you know in the literary community? Who might you connect me with? And I just reached out to a bunch of people. And with that too, just like the book, we got a lot more submissions than we could include, which is sort of, you know, a necessity of these projects. Like you have to be able to kind of shape a project out of materials that you get. But it really, truly ended up being, I think I procrastinated for months on just starting, because it just felt like after I kind of made the case to McSweeney's for it and finally convinced myself like, yes, we have to also have an international supplement, and then great, we're doing it. And then I was like, how do I do this? Like, what? And so for months, I was just such a burden on me. And eventually when I started, it was like within weeks, it was all, you know, I had commitments from like way more people than I knew I'd be able to include. So it just came together so beautifully.
I thought it was so great to read, especially countries you just mentioned, like Afghanistan. And for me personally, for example, the piece of China was interesting and also heart-wrenching, really, because I mean, obviously, I knew about this family, you know, regulation policies of China, and that it only recently has been exactly the one child policy, and then that policy. It has been expanded policy to, you know, two children and then three. But it really never occurred to me to think deeper about it, you know, and to then see it on the page, you know, in such a sort of dense way, what that means, you know, to use this very general word, but I don't really know to how to express this any other way. It was just for me, and this again is like, this is credit to the power also to your curating, but I guess also to the power of, you know, writing and fiction and creative nonfiction and this compilation, you know, to access stories that are way beyond the scope of what you know, and like you said very much earlier, that this is our liberal problem, that we always think we know everything, but, you know, obviously we don't know anything. You know, I have, and I think it's, for me personally, it's always really important to remind myself exactly of that, to be like, oh yeah, of course, you know, this is the reality in China. It's this huge country, and there's so many billions of women who, you know, and generations who went through this. So for me, that was one of the most sort of enriching and broadening texts, even though it's, you know, as a form, it's very, you know, straightforward, but still, like, the content was for me very exciting. And
I think that's the power, right, of art and literature in particular, is that when you know of a policy, how different is that than hearing one person's story and hearing the specific ways in which this shaped or affected one life? You know, it's amazing how one is technically so much bigger than the other, like millions or billions of women, and yet the other is so much more powerful, which is the story of one person that we identify with. And
I mean,
that's exactly why. Go ahead.
No, sorry. Continue.
No, that's why I think it's such, literature and art is such a crucial ingredient in our response, our understanding of and processing of and response to injustice, to social crisis, to fighting for social change. I have been meaning to ask you, because that's a topic I've been thinking so much about, like, how do you think of that? How do you experience that in Germany? Is art considered there, and literature in particular, sort of, Is that a radical thought, or is that like an obvious thought to think of literature in response to social causes?
Oh no, of course. I mean, we are a nation which considers itself very, you know, liberal, and also the nation of the thinkers and the poets. You know, this is how the Germans see themselves, or they like to see themselves. Which I have a lot to say about this, which would, like, you know, take us until the day after tomorrow. So
on yet another side tour.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's do this on another podcast, you know, or, you know, even just the two of us at some point. Of course, you know, artists and writers also in particular, of course, we all feel that we have to respond to social movements, injustices, issues in a way, you know, be it drama or art or, you know, writing. And it happens. It does happen. It's just, I think the reality, especially of publishing, which we talked about earlier, is the fact that, which you also write about in your foreword, is that it's so slow. And that, you know, if someone would write a book today about, I mean, if you write about violence against women, this is going to be an issue in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, sadly, but, you know, so it's never going to go out of fashion, so to say. But it's the fact that the publishing industry here, and I think this is what makes your project and also the whole idea and the whole thing of McSweeney so special, is it's an independent publisher, but it's a very known publisher. And I mean, partly, of course, because of Dave Eggers, I'm sure, and because it's so, like, the quality of the text that McSweeney's publishes is so good, you know, and it's just so relevant. And I was thinking about this earlier that we don't have something like that here. We have, you know, the big players, you know, like Random House and Penguin, which is all like a global conglomerate. Then we have traditional German publishing houses, which are now also part of conglomerates, obviously. And they have, you know, massive programs. So they have to work, you know, slowly and only in very special cases, just sort of shoot things out, you know, because, you know, it has to. And then we have the independent publishers, which is, I think, is a very, very nice scene, but obviously it's completely uneconomic and it's, there's no money to be made there. Other if you're maybe subsidized by the state. And so, you know, they cannot afford oftentimes to pay writers, to pay translators, to pay editors the way they want to, and they should be compensated for their work. So they have a very, speaking of access, their access to doing what they might want to do is so limited due to financial situation, you know. And considering that, there's a lot of great things happening, but I feel like, you know, it's a different story. And I guess maybe it's also because we're limited to the German language, whereas when you're an English speaking publisher, you have so much more streams of revenue coming in, you know. It's like so, you know, how many people read German? You know, we have 80 million people living in Germany, and of those, probably 5 read books. So it's like, you know, not 5 million, but like 5 people. But yeah, so this is, you know, and then it's the quality also, you know. What I was sort of hinting at earlier is that I oftentimes think I had this, there's a particular example that really nicely connects with Indelible. Because obviously for the Me Too movement, there was also an anthology in German coming out, and it was so, and it was called She Said, and it was short fiction, you know, it was plainly fiction, and it came out in a very big publishing house, and there were very good writers in it, but I felt it was very purely curated, was very purely poorly edited, not purely poorly edited, because you could feel that this was just sort of thrown together at a pace. So to just like throw it out there because, oh yeah, we need a Me Too book now. We need a response. And so I'm not a fan of what, you know, publishing houses do, because it always feels rushed and it doesn't feel carefully, you know, put together like you do, you know, with your work. And I feel like people who would want to do this, they don't get the opportunity because the publishers either say, no, this has to come out like yesterday, or, you know, we would love to do it, but I'm sorry, we cannot pay you. We've talked a lot now. Can I like put to you like one last sort of small train of thought, which is related to what you were asking about writing and art and activism, but it's, you know, you did Indelible, you did now this project. What's next? And also like, this is the one thing, because obviously we have so many crises that you could now attend to and you know, do a book on climate change, do a book on, you know, whatever, on war. Sorry, and peace. Oh, someone already did war and peace.
Damn.
But also the one thing that I was really curious about, like personally, because I know probably like me, you're a bit of too much of an idealist. I think this is where we connect also. We haven't talked about our pieces now, but I feel like this is going to be a stretch, but we're going to do this privately. I'm just going to say that Shelley's piece is really great in the book. And for a Middle Eastern woman, this was really eye-opening to read also. But yeah, being an idealist, how do you deal with the frustrations of all of these things that we talked about? You know, the fact that, you know, you want to yell at your friends. I mean, I haven't even asked you what you're hoping this book will do, because I mean, it would be super naive to think that you would give this to someone in a red state wearing a, you know, Make America Great Again hat, and they would change their mind, you know, and it's the same here.
I would not hand this book to person in a MAGA hat in a red state. I would probably not even be interfacing with that person in that situation, but if I did, I would not hand over this book to them.
But it's a conundrum, isn't it? It's like we do this work that we do, you know, and we already know that the work is probably not going to leave our liberal intellectual bubble as much, you know. I mean, to a certain extent, of course, you know, it's going to reach readers, you know, but what is it, you know, what is it, to put it like very philosophically, what is it all for? What makes you hope?
Oh, Russia.
I know, I'm sorry. As I was saying it, I was like, okay, this is really dumb.
No, it's not dumb at all. It's like, that's why I'm sighing, is because it's not dumb. It's true and not what we want to think about.
No,
I wouldn't come out of bed in the morning
if we thought about it too much.
That's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. So that's kind of my second point. But let me start with the first one. I do actually think, especially when it comes to reproductive freedom, that, you know, it's not quite as black and white as like red, blue, people who have been already fighting for reproductive freedom versus people in MAGA hats. That's not, there's so many people who I think share mine and your values when it comes to reproductive rights and reproductive freedom who are really only now waking up to this reality. And honestly, I'm sure many, millions probably, who still haven't. That's just the nature of these things. That is where I do think art and literature can play a role. Now, is that a naive belief? Maybe. And that's where I connect to my second point, which I don't care if it is. That's what I need to believe in order to get out of bed in the morning. I quite literally, like, that's not even hyperbolic. That is just a statement of truth. If I went to bed thinking art doesn't matter and has no effect, and what's the point? There is no point. I would literally not get out of bed in the morning. And so I have to believe that, and thank God that I do.
Yeah. You know,
whether I'm just bullshitting myself and buying my own bullshit, whatever it is, it works. I hope it never stops working. I hope I always continue to believe in it no matter what, because it is an essential ingredient to my own well-being and sanity. But I really do believe it, which is why I do really believe that a book like that hopefully can open the hearts and minds of many people. You know what? It's also when it is good company to the hearts and minds of many who have been fighting, that is not nothing either. If that gives those people more, more support, more air in their lungs, more, you know, whatever the right way to put it, but just gives them more strength to keep going. That is so much too. That translates into so much as well. I do think it can also reach the hearts and minds of people who, again, maybe share our values, but don't necessarily or haven't been tapped into what is going on, haven't necessarily been fighting, haven't necessarily been translating their values into actions. And maybe a story or an essay or a poem or a play or a photograph or a comic just hits that right note for them and makes them feel something or think into something in a new way. And that is certainly is my hope, or one of my main hopes for this book and this project.
I feel like, yeah, I mean, art is so nurturing if it's good art. And I, like you said, you know, it's fuel in the tank. And it's, I did a podcast with two colleagues of mine on the Scottish writer Ali Smith a few weeks back. And
I'm a huge fan.
Same. Oh yeah. God. I mean, and we basically got hung up on her quote, which is because, I mean, you know, this whole seasonal quartet, you know, and it's about the
the
present that we live in. And she said, hope comes from not hoping. And I feel like this is the perfect place for us also to end this, because, you know, as dire as everything has been and is, you know, around us in the US, but also here in Europe, you know, hope comes from not hoping. And let's not stop doing art and reading art and, you know, do what we do. Mm-hmm. Because maybe we'll move the needle just a little bit. That would be nice. Or even if not, like we contribute that the needle doesn't even go further right. That would be also good enough.
Yeah, that's actually quite meaningful nowadays. Just that, just preventing things from getting worse is actually so much, right?
Such a low bar, but you know, we'll do whatever it takes.
It is.
And then again, not also.
Right. I mean, if you think of climate change, then it's pretty clear that that's a huge thing, actually. Right. Yeah. Like, who among us would not say, where do I sign if we were offered just the status quo and nothing deteriorating anymore, which obviously, sadly, tragically, is no longer available to us and hasn't been in a while. Yeah. But just that's a good, you know, sort of metaphor in a way to think about other things as well. Yes, it's a low bar, but also it's that's a meaningful accomplishment. And maybe, you know, we're sort of fucked when it comes to climate change in oh so many ways, but maybe with some of these other causes, we can achieve that. As you said, the needle not, at least not moving further in the wrong direction. And that is meaningful. That's worth fighting for.
I haven't asked like half of the questions on my paper, but I feel like we.
I think you also wanted me to read from.
I know. We haven't like we went off into so many directions, but I feel like, you know, let's just stop this here and continue at another time. Otherwise, you know, this is going to be a never ending story. Mm-hmm. Shelly, thank you so much for speaking to me here and for your work also, especially, and for inviting all of us to be part of it. And yeah. Nothing but the best of luck.
All of these fronts. Thank you for having me. And thank you so much for your essay in the supplement, which I love. And I encourage listeners to seek that out and to read that piece and to know about Russia's aunt. And that'll be the cliffhanger and how she might connect to various aspects of reproductive freedom. Let me just make it cryptic. So
thank you.
People read that piece.
We'll put all of this in the description of the podcast. And so thank you again, Shelly.
Thank you so much. This was lovely as ever.
Das war die neue Ausgabe von Fempire, dem Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben. Diesmal mit der israelisch-amerikanischen Autorin, Kuratorin und Aktivistin Shelly Oria über ihr aktuelles Projekt I Know What's Best for You, Stories about Reproductive Freedom, über weibliche körperliche Autonomie und Fortpflanzungsfragen, erschienen bei McSweeney's in den USA, aber auch bei uns bestell- und lieferbar und wie ich finde, unbedingt zu lesen. Ich hoffe, es hat euch Spaß gemacht, genauso viel Spaß, wie es uns gemacht hat, das Gespräch zu führen. Beim nächsten Mal wird es wieder ein klassisches Vampire geben mit einer Autorin über die Werke einer anderen Autorin. Und bis dahin wünsche ich euch eine ganz gute Zeit. Mein Name ist Hala Shachayat, Schriftstellerin, Übersetzerin, Aktivistin und Host von Vampire, dem Podcast über Frauen, die schreiben.